Dr. Vandana Shiva is a critic of big farming. It'll be our ruin, she says. The solution, she told the Food Matters Aotearoa conference in Wellington over the weekend, is thinking small and thinking organic. I spoke to the former quantum physicist before she spoke to those delegates. I began by asking her why she switched from studying the nature of matter to becoming an agricultural activist.
Well, sustainable agriculture really was a journey I started in 1984. As an ecologist, I was already working. I was helping movements at the grassroots during my holidays and vacations, beginning with the Chipko movement, the movement of women coming out to hug trees and say, we won't let the Himalayan forests be cut. And after 11 years, we got a very strong forest policy and forest act. But 1984, you might recall, was the disaster of Bhopal when the Union Carbide pesticide plant leaked. It was also the year when Punjab, which is the land where chemical agriculture was introduced in India under the name of the Green Revolution, Punjab in 84 was really a land of civil war. The army had been sent to the Golden Temple.
Yes.
And so by the end of the year, I was asking myself, if 3,000 people die in Bhopal, 30,000 have been killed in violence in Punjab, how did the Green Revolution get a Nobel Peace Prize? What was it about? So I was working for the United Nations as a consultant on natural resource policy in a mega program on peace and global transformation. And they'd asked me, because of my work in ecology, to do this. And I said to the UN, I said, something's going on here. It's big and I want to study it. And they were more than happy that I do. And so I wrote a book after studying what the Green Revolution was. And I was so shocked by what I found. First, that we never really needed chemicals in agriculture. They were chemicals left over after the wars, for which a market was found in agriculture. And second, that agriculture, for example, in India, is what led to the organic movement worldwide. The British had sent Albert Howard, who turned the Indian peasant into his professor, wrote a book called The Agriculture Testament. I read everything under the sun at that time, and then decided I was going to dedicate my life to nonviolent farming, which meant I had to study a lot of ecology in agriculture. I'd already been doing a lot of ecological work for our environment ministry, for our other government programs, but that's when I said I'm going to do this. In 87, I was invited to a meeting on biotechnology, where the old chemical industry was now becoming the biotech industry, and they laid out their future. And I said, I'm going to save seeds. Now I'll save seeds.
Did you grow up in a city or in the country?
Well, I went to school in cities, but my father was a forest conservator. My mother, who was an inspectress of schools, had got trapped on the other side of the border during the partition. And when she came back, she said, I've done all the studies I needed to do. I had reached the top in government service. Now I want to be a farmer. So holidays were either in the forest with my dad or on the farm she was setting up.
How much did that shape your view and your approach to what you do now?
I think it definitely had an influence. It had an influence because I didn't treat dirt as dirt. Yes, playing with the soil on our mother's farm was one of the happiest moments of life. Walking the forest, respecting the species, seeing the connection between streams and oak forests was something one grew up in. And that's why later in life, I did not get absorbed into what I would call the anti-scientific tradition that tries to deny the work of the earth, the work of the forest, the work of the rivers, the work of the soil. It's been, for me, nature has personhood. And that was part of my childhood. It's also part of my culture, which says we live in an earth family, Vasudheva Kutumbakam, which means the family of the earth, literally. And while I trained in physics, I did not end up locking my brain in an abstract world.
When you talk about the Green Revolution, what do you mean by that? Is there a couple of things that I think about in terms of what happened to farming after the Second World War? And you mentioned there are chemicals left over, chemicals then used in insecticides and in fertilizers. But the other thing that happened was that internal combustion machines made it possible for tractors to work the land, for other machines to do the harvesting. Is that part of the Green Revolution, or for you something separate?
No, it's all part of the Green Revolution. The Green Revolution is basically replacing ecological processes and ecological functions that allow humanity to renew soil fertility and increase it through organic manures, controlled pests through ecological balance of both plants in their diversity as well as insects in their diversity, because they're amazing pest-predator relationships in nature, as well as the work of human beings with the soil, the replacement by man and by chemicals and machines is very much part of the Green Revolution, based on a very false productivity calculation, because that chemical fossil fuel package translates into 10 units of inputs and 1 unit of output, a negative productivity. The rest is going into entropy, waste, the greenhouse gas emissions. I wrote a book called Soil Not Oil about 3-4 years ago, in which I tried to add up all the contributions from industrial farming systems to greenhouse gases and climate change. It's more than 40%. So we are talking about the biggest chunk of the damage to the environment in terms of climate change coming from an industrial model of farming dependent on chemicals and fossil fuels, including chemicals that are made from fossil fuels like chemical fertilizers.
How do we go about farming in a sustainable way then if we're not to use machines, whether they use fossil fuel or not? Do we get rid of the tractors and the harvesters?
Well, the first thing is we don't have to start destroying small farms under the false assumption of productivity. The United Nations has put out the data last year, because last year was the UN year of the family farm, that 70% of the food we eat comes from small farms. And yet the mythology is only large farms produce the food. Most of what's produced on large-scale industrial farms is actually not even food. It's commodities that go to produce biofuels, animal feed. So this huge violence against the soil and biodiversity on the one hand, but against the small family farm on the other, which in my country translates into violence against more than half the population. The idea that you can just trash the small farm. We're talking about something like $400 billion subsidies being given to large-scale agribusiness. In India, I just briefed our parliament before coming to New Zealand. Parliament wanted to know, why isn't sustainable agriculture growing further? What are the obstacles? And I laid out the budgets. I said, more than 4 trillion rupees going to promote a non-sustainable agriculture. So what I would say simply is, if there's a small farm, let it survive as a small farm. If there's a small tractor, let it survive as a small tractor. You don't have to bring the combined harvesters and wipe out everything on the small, because the small is more productive.
What would happen if we had small farmers only? Would we? How would we be able to feed the growing world population without the massive use of machinery, not just in terms of what happens on a farm, but also in terms of getting food from one part of the world to the other?
Well, as I mentioned already, 70% of the food comes from small farms. And two forces are creating a new imperative for policy to protect the small farm as the pillar of sustainability. The first is the recognition that 75% of the biodiversity has been destroyed by industrial agriculture. More than 75% of the water gets used, abused, polluted by industrial agriculture. 75% of the land degradation, soil desertification comes from those methods. So the ecological imperative is requiring sustainability, and sustainability works at that level. The second is the unemployment crisis. Now, 2008, we had the collapse of Wall Street. That then spread the virus of instability everywhere in the world. India didn't suffer too much because we had very strong capital controls. But Europe, especially Southern Europe, went under. Half of the youth of Greece, of Italy, of Spain, of Portugal are unemployed. I work with many of these governments. I work with many of the communities in these areas. The only place where they can find work is with the land. So this idea that history is a linear inclined progress from agriculture to industry to service, it's not working. It is an evolution of a recognition that taking care of the soil is the most significant activity, whether it's relating to climate change. The scientific calculations are showing that we could actually absorb 100% of the carbon dioxide if all the soil of the world was made organic, which would also have 200 liters per cubic meter, which would allow us to deal with the kind of drought you're facing this year, I was told, in New Zealand, and California has had for 5 years, and we're going to see more intense droughts with climate change. And we're definitely going to see more and more unemployment, but even where there's employment, there's loss of meaning. I run a training center. I call it the Earth University. We help people. I started out just teaching farmers how to save seeds and do organic. And now we get bank work, you know, people from finance, people from the IT industry. We get prosperous people earning 200,000, 300,000 rupees a month. And they're saying, inside I'm empty. I want to farm. So we can't write off farming. And we can't write off working with the soil. I've just been to this wonderful Maori school where the children learn through gardening. We are creating gardens of hope everywhere. There is no deeper lesson in biology, in geography, in math, in physics, in chemistry, in earth citizenship than working the soil and being a gardener or a farmer.
Nights on Radio New Zealand National. I'm speaking to Dr. Vandana Shiva. She's a scholar and activist. She's in New Zealand to speak at a conference about sustainable agriculture and land use. Did you say that what if we had organic soil that would absorb all our carbon dioxide, or just the carbon dioxide that we're putting off at the moment?
It would absorb all the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere today, and because it would be the shift in land use of a very, very large scale, it would prevent future emissions. Because what's not seen is that the tropical rainforests are being cut because of a model of agriculture. We shouldn't be growing palm oil and finishing off the rainforests of Indonesia and Malaysia if agriculture systems allowed local edible oils to survive. All of India's edible oils have been finished because of dumping of soya and palm oil.
But I wouldn't want all the soil to eat up all the carbon dioxide, because we need carbon dioxide for greenhouse gas. We had no CO2.
I didn't mean bring it down below survival levels. Yeah.
Suddenly life would get very cold here.
The extra pollution that is beyond the capacity of the biosphere to absorb. That is what it solves. Because the soil is the biggest sink.
If we keep more small farmers going, if we support small farmers, is that really helping people to get out? Because being a small farmer, it's tough, isn't it? You're never going to make a lot of money.
Well, you just said...
The reason I say that is because, okay, if I talk about the Industrial Revolution from a Western perspective, we had a lot of people through mechanisation, not necessarily fertilisers and chemicals, because they, as you point out, didn't come until after the Second World War on the whole, but we certainly had industrialisation, which made it possible for a tractor to do the work of many, many more people than a horse and a plough could do. We had people coming into the cities, and there was a lot of dislocation. It's a lot of pain involved in that change. A lot of things were lost. But on the whole, the standard of living for most people was much better now that most of us live in big cities.
Well, three quick things on that. Gandhi, who, as you know, helped energize India's freedom movement, he returned to India only in 1915. Our independence movement was growing before that. But one of the things he said, if it takes one little island nation, the colonizing of all the lands of the world, 80% of the lands of the world, for this model of industrialization, I don't want it. So when you talk about those machines running, you forget that those machines could only get their cotton from the plantations that were run by slaves. You forget that India's cotton industry, which is the biggest and the best, had to be destroyed in order to create the markets. That indigo was forced on Indian peasants to supply the appetite for blue dye. But the second issue is, you just talked about obesity because we are not working. I think one of the singular illusions we live under in the definition of false productivity is we behave as if human work and human effort is a curse. And then we complain that everyone's getting too fat and obese because no one's working. I think, you know, productivity is very simply output per unit input. Inputs in the case of something like agriculture include the amount of water you put into it, the amount of fossil fuels we put into it, the amount of chemicals you put into it, the amount of resources you put into it. That's never counted. So as I said, we have 10 units of input in energy and resource terms to provide one calorie. 10 kilocalories to provide one kilocalorie. Hugely inefficient. How do we do it? By hiding the fact that you got rid of people but are working with 300 energy slaves in their place, which are the fossil fuel slaves. And you're treating people as disposable. Now, in a country like India, where most people are farmers and small farmers, people are not saying, put me off the land. They're fighting with their lives, saying, I will not leave the land. Land struggles are the biggest issue in Africa, in Latin America, in India, in societies that are still agrarian. But just flip in your head a little bit. Suppose natural resource inputs were brought into consideration rather than labor as the only input. We would have a very different economic calculus. We would define agricultural productivity very differently. But most importantly, because I work with young people and I work with children, when you talk small farms, there's all the baggage of large machines, efficient. Think of the garden. Think of the fact that nobody says we shouldn't have a garden. Think of the fact that even in cities, people are starting to make gardens on their terraces and balconies. What we have is a choice for the future.
And I'm one of those who loves gardening. But I think about this when I do my gardening, because I've got a couple of things that guide what I do. And one is I don't spend much money on my garden, because I want it to be, in its own small way, a little bit of a contribution to the household in terms of saving income. So I don't go out. That's one of the reasons I don't go out and get lots of fertilizers and things like that. There's another thing that I notice when I'm gardening. It takes a long time for me to make a reasonably small amount of food. And I've thought as I've gardened, and I love my garden, and I love gardening, that if I relied on my own labour to provide the food for myself and my family, I would be very poor. And I live in a society where gardening for me is a choice, not a matter of life and death, because I can go out and work and make a lot more money doing something else.
Well, the first thing is, gardens can produce huge amounts. I got a beautiful letter from an unemployed youth in Detroit after he read my book, Soil Not Oil, in which, as I said, building soil is the most important vocation of humanity. He said, I'm unemployed. I read your book. I started a garden. Now I feed my entire community and my entire street. And I have meaning in life and I have community. My mother, as I mentioned, became a refugee after the partition, decided to become a farmer. She supported our higher education, our education and higher education, on what she earned. My dad had a very high-level government job as a forest conservator, but he earned less, even though he was at a very high level, because in those days, India's agriculture policy decided farmers should be rewarded. Today, under globalization, the policy is let the farmers not earn an income. I've had debates with the biotech industry, which said, by the time we are through, the corn a farmer grows will have no value. It's the genes we put into it that'll have value. I've done analysis as Walmart was trying to come into India, and of course people were saying, oh, farmers will earn more. And so, of course, I did world analysis. What happens when Walmart starts to control agriculture? 2% of what a consumer pays goes to the farmer. So both under the production model of industrial agriculture and the economic model of so-called free trade, which is only free for industry and corporations, but not free for citizens, farmers' incomes are dropping. For Cancun, I did a briefing paper for our commerce minister, showing that at that point, and Cancun is already a decade behind us, in that year, at that point, $25 billion were the lost incomes of our farmers because of dumping. All that $400 billion that makes our prices artificially cheap, and then the dumping. Or monopolies and monopsonies, which buy cheap from the farmer. So you have a model in which the cost of production has become 10 times more, and what the farmer is earning is one-tenth. So in energy equation is 10 to 1. In farmer's income, it's 10 to 1. No profession could survive. If you were here working for Radio New Zealand and they were paying you much less than what your survival costs, you wouldn't be saying, gardening won't support me. You'll be saying, radio journalism doesn't support me. It depends on an unfair market.
I'd
the
be
market
selling my Brussels
unfair
sprouts.
Is very bad.
What you've told me what you want to see. What do you think is going to happen to the world food system?
Well, we have two futures, as I mentioned. We have one future where nothing is growing faster than the organic movement and the gardening movement. On the other hand, you're also seeing the devastation of small farmers, agriculture as a whole, where agriculture is being made artificially unviable, not just in India, but everywhere. I'm sure the situation of a dairy farmer of New Zealand is not very different. I definitely know in Brussels, they come every once in a while with tractors to dump milk because milk prices have dropped below the cost of production and you just can't survive. Now, if that carries on and all we have then is industrial systems of industrial production, at the end of the day, industry is only seeking how to maximize its profits. So not only will you have large-scale use of chemicals like Roundup, like glyphosate, you're going to have more and more use of GMOs because most people don't realize GMOs are not about food production. They're about collecting royalties from seed through patenting. That's the main purpose GMOs exist. And if 1 acre can get me royalty every year, then I'm going to sell the kind of seeds on which I can have a patent, not the kind of seeds that a farmer can save and grow out next year. So at the end of the day, what we'll have a farming system which will trash the earth further. I talked about 75% of the vital resources that produce our food, our biodiversity, our soil, our water, are already being destroyed till today. And this is United Nations figures. For a system that's only providing us 30% of the food, if we take this 30% to 45%, we'll have trashed the planet. So not only will hunger continue, we won't have a planet to grow food on. A dead planet cannot produce food. And that can be a very real future in a very short run. And just as a follow-up, we wouldn't be seeing what happened in Syria if it wasn't for the kind of drought that led to 800,000 people, peasants being displaced. We wouldn't see Boko Haram if it wasn't for Lake Chad. So not only will we see hunger rise, we'll see conflicts grow. And that's something most policymakers are not able to connect to farming, the land, and how we use it.
The agricultural activist and writer, Dr. Vandana Shiva.